speaker last year, and then he told us in Passau there will be an institute founded with Professor Malte Rehbein, didn't you invite him? So very spontaneous, yeah, I didn't know him. And then I said, oh, okay, we wait until we can present more. This time I invited him, because in April he invited us to Passau. There was a big conference, and this poster is a part of this, was presented at this conference, and also I had a talk together with Christian Erbacher from the Wittgenstein Archives. He was also in Passau, and it was a very interesting conference about digital humanities im deutschsprachigen Raum. So they selected writings from the deutschsprachigen Raum. And Malte Rehbein was the leader, he was also there. And this time I invited him, but I must say, sorry for me that he has no time, but that it's usually lecture time, so he cannot come. But he sent me his chief student, Joshua Schäuble, because he works exactly on this research field where he's now getting also a BFG project. And ideas from this project, they are coming from Walter Gabler.
The materials, yes.
The materials come from Walter Gabler. So I'm happy to have both here to talk about this idea.
Thanks for rearranging the program so that we can share this platform. Now, very briefly, journal that you were just so impressively presenting, it's something that takes me back to developments that I've been witnessing and partly been consulting since the early 2000s. Italian-born French researcher Paolo Di Orio came to Munich with his Heimer Nietzsche project at the time. It was an early phase in his Nietzsche interests that were focused on the genetics of writing and of text. He set up a series of projects that involved others, and one perhaps the most productive and consistently imaginatively developing project among those various groups has always been the Bergen-Wittgenstein Archive and the Agora project, from which that OJS as a result was, in that series of things. The idea of such a journal was, as I indicated before, already implied in that early Wittgenstein conception. Now, what I said before is now also relevant, because it is a matter of defining what body of text one chooses for one's for a research platform, as the basis for a research platform. It is my conception and my conviction that the future of the scholarly edition, the medium for the future scholarly edition, is the digital medium. Because editions are always concerned with variation, therefore with the flexibility and the development of text, that happens in writing, that happens in publication. Why we are interested in editing is because not every textual transmission is identical with another. And therefore, that kind of flexibility, that kind of development, that kind of interchange, that a kind of dialogue between material texts is what editing is always about. And the medium that can capture that and at least give us the illusion that we can see all that that activity again, that activity of dialogue between various versions of a text, that dialogue between the writer, the author, and the several versions of text that sometimes he or she puts on one sheet of paper, is what editing is about. And that's why genetic editing has become such an interesting area of future research in scholarly editing. Now, and this is where even 10 years ago, I felt that I wanted to take up the Hyper Nietzsche system of marking up Nietzsche manuscripts. For Virginia Woolf's never published sketches of something she calls Sketch of the Past. Virginia Woolf apparently wanted to gather material towards an autobiography. She had never before put to paper her memories about her youth and childhood, and that's what she put down. She put it down in segments every now and then. When she got stale, as she says, with other work she was doing, she was writing a few pages in manuscript and then typing out that. Now, this material is interesting because it is initially, it's unachieved. It's something that you see on paper, it's happening there. In that sense, it is not dissimilar from what you people are dealing with in terms of Wittgenstein, although, of course, yours is much more complex and stretches over a far longer time. But Virginia Woolf, in those pieces of manuscript we have, you can see her writing, and as everybody does, changing things here and there, adding something, striking something out even as she goes along, because the way she wants to put something often comes to her only as she is in the process of writing. And then she sits down maybe that same afternoon or a few days later and takes that bunch of manuscript sheets that she has and types them, but not the way you think a typist would, namely trying to copy it literally. She reads it, wonders about it, changes in her head, and what comes on paper on the typescript is often excitingly different from what was there in the manuscript before. Now, if for a journal you have a body of a secondary writing that you link, as you very clearly explained before, the much finer granularity is when you find a text being in the process of being written and find that kind of variation happening as a dialogue of stages of the text with earlier stages of the text and of the author in dialogue with what is already on the page and responding to it differently. And then in this case of Virginia Woolf, we have that extraordinary moment where she reacts to something she's already written in manuscript, but we don't see how we just see the result, and we don't, as it were, see how it may have happened. We can, and we should, as editor, that's at least my view, we should be able to display what she writes in the manuscript in several layers, so that we can distinguish an early stage from a later stage of that writing. And we should be able to continue to observe variation across document borders, so that, in a sense, as a text, there is a continuous development, and the first typing on the typescript, which is different from the last writing in the manuscript, means that where it is different, it is the next stage of development crossing the border of manuscripts. This requires, for the digital medium, a markup, as we all know, and a markup that captures our analysis of what's going on. As you rightly said, that's the whole point of the markup, to codify our understanding of what there is. Transcription for such material never means just transposing to another document, but it means transposing it with a coding that that gives us that records what we think we are doing, and that therefore can be extrapolated and can be used for all sorts of visualizations. Harris this morning, spoke about the kinds of things that one could think of wanting, and the unknown reader may be wanting something that we couldn't even imagine. And our fancy is that our market is then still going to be so good that even what we don't anticipate can be extracted. Text Encoding Initiative set up a committee about 3 years ago because they finally realized that text encoding should include something that is not just text. I mean, they are, in a sense, working against their own first principles. That is to say that TEI should include genetic markup and should have a markup that one could refer to and that one could use more or less in the same ways or in compatible ways that would give the diachrony of writing, that is to say, the genetic development of writing into text. And but the Hypernicha markup language designed by the Hypernicha project 10 years ago already had something like that. They were anticipating what happened with TI about 8 years later. My Virginia Woolf material has been marked up throughout with this Hypernicha markup language. That is the new proposal for a markup from XML TEI P5 is much more sophisticated than the HML was. Also, the Hypernicha people have abandoned the genetic thing. I don't know whether they're going to ever take it up again. So there was no development from what happened 10 years ago. That's why I was, strongly wished all that Hypernicha markup language to be transformed into XML TI markup. Therefore, the Virginia Woolf, my little research project, has been brought into a two-year project financed jointly by the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Which is a program that Walter Rehbein conceived of and works on together with Anne Bodenkamp of the Faust edition in Frankfurt, which is the one edition in Germany which is the most advanced edition in terms of genetic understanding and genetic editing. And within that project, I brought in the Virginia Woolf and also the Ulysses thing because that is already in, genetically organized in its markup, but I'm not going to go into that. I'm ending here and saying that in practical terms, Joshua Schäuble, who is a Wissenschaftliche Hilfskraft in that project now, is undertaking the task of converting the Hypernicha markup language into XML TIP5 with a genetic markup. And that was also the stimulus, I believe, for your bachelor thesis, which you recently submitted. And so please now tell us what you have seen. And how you approach that?
I'm trying to keep it as short as possible now because the time is
As you rightly believe, after I've talked so long already.
And you already said quite a lot of stuff that I wanted to say as well. So you probably already all read the title. It's not the best English. I was actually expecting to speak in German, and I just translated it while I was sitting there in the last 2 hours. So if I thought about it longer, I would have given a better English title. So the idea is I'm checking on concepts of versioning in the computer sciences and try to kind of use these concepts to simulate a text genetic process on the basis of the data that he just explained to you. So, and the question then is, can we learn something from what is already given in the computer sciences so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel? So that's then basically been how I structured my thesis. First I formulated a research question, then I've developed a research design, and then I've analyzed my results. The research question basically is what I just explained. What can we learn from versioning concepts of the computer sciences for the diachronic portrayal of critical apparatuses? And since you already explained the apparatus, I think I can skip quite a lot of that stuff. So the research design, first of all, it is quite important that I'm using software here that is not by any means software of the digital humanities area. So the idea is that you kind of look, well, they do stuff that we don't do with TI. With TI, you always include all the markup in one file, and I'm trying to find out then, well, if we try to visualize TI later, especially the historical critical elements, the diachronic parts, then what can we kind of learn from what we already have in other computer scientific areas? So there's basically only information about the text that I used. Maybe it's interesting to use like 147 pages of of TypeScript, and she's got handwritten correction on everything. But since you already explained it, I'll just show you some pictures of it because that makes a bit more clear how it looks. So that's kind of her handwriting, and that's the TypeScript. And you can always see that she's, well, these are from her husband, the blue ones. The Leonard Wolf, for example, changed things, corrected things. And here we also have the same, like she's striking through things or overriding things. And sometimes this happens like ad hoc while she's writing. Sometimes she's doing it later. On the TypeScript, she also changes things herself by using a pencil, or she just changes them by overtyping them with the same machine.
The special situation with Leonard Wolf, the husband, he got hold of this TypeScript after her suicide, and decided he wanted somebody to retype it. It was terribly full of typing mistakes, and the typing mistakes are densest where she was obviously thinking about new text. And so, in a sense, those marks have nothing to do with Virginia Woolf's own invention. They are her husband's instructions to a later typist.
And what I first did, of course, is I tried to understand all the data I had, which is not too easy if you've never worked with something like that. And luckily, I had then the Hyper-Nietzsche version that Professor Gabler gave to me. Because, for example, we have things like this how, and there was an end underneath. And I couldn't read it, but you could obviously read it. And
everybody can do it now.
Yeah, you allow it, then you have like a bigger picture of it, you can tell that it's actually an end. But if I had to do that all on my own, I would have had by far too much work. Yeah, that's just examples of what I already explained. Like, she's, for example, giving
pencil.
Yeah, she's doing a pencil here, yes. Which is kind of a variation. And then here, later, says, okay, I'm accepting the variation, and strikes through the severe, and thereby accepts Hahn and Stella. It's just, yeah, the way they worked together. And what I then did is kind of, reconstructed the first stage of every of the two things I had, like the TypeScript and the manuscript, and then made lists of all the changes on every stage. And then in the two softwares I used, which the first one is MediaWiki, and the second one is Subversion Subclips. And we're just both software that kind of tries to control versions. I then just started with the first stage, which was done by Virginia. I set up the software on a local test server and made user for all the users we have. On his Hyper-Nietzsche version, he also has some changes, which is why he also got a user from me. And then I just like simulated the process of the development of this text. So then I had some assessment criteria. It is a pretty experimental approach because it could have gone wrong. It could have been that in the end I wouldn't have anything to write about. But yeah, I tried to make it as structured as possible. So I had assessment criteria, and I wanted to judge the software on the data storage, on collation algorithms, on the visualization, and on the suitability of the idea to digitalize something by simulation. So, and then I've got four more slides, one slide for each of these categories. When it comes to the data storage, nothing what I found out is really new. It is not really the best idea to only count on TEI. So we also need databases in addition, and we also may consider object-oriented approaches to connect or link the data we have. And we've already heard quite a lot about that today, that people do have big data in TEI and then try to collect out several information out of the metadata just to put it in databases and calculate on it. And I think that's something we also have to do in this case, because we have a far bigger potential to link our information and to also kind of interactively show it afterwards. Also, what is quite obvious is that the TEI version, or HNML version in this case, does not really stick to any software engineering patterns. So there's all the information about the text, all the information of the text, all the graphical information in one file. And if you then are looking at only one thing, like you are only interested in the description of her handwriting, or the description of her handwriting in several different works, then you always have to go through all of these files instead of going through one database where you can just get it out easily. Okay, then when it comes to collation algorithms, I described quite a lot how they work, but the result is that they're quite useless for this approach, and that there are by far better algorithms that are specifically made for collating text or prose. Like, for example, we worked with Juxta the last time we met, or there are programs that, of course, do
you
things
with
Juxta or Juxta. J-U-X-T-R. And just to show you a bit how such things then look, this algorithm kind of looks for lines that are the same and then highlights differences in the same lines. But if you then go over this border of the document where you, for example, change from the manuscript to a TypeScript, then it's not even able to bring the right lines together anymore. So it's really not an algorithm that helps us here. Okay. Then when it comes to the visualization, for the MediaWiki software, it's quite clear that its limits are exactly where the limits for nowadays web design are. Like, you could easily build add-ons using Bootstrap or whatever is hip these days. What then, though, is interesting that we should also, in my opinion, use such technologies to make digital editions more appealing and to make it easier to get the information out of the text that you want to get. With Subclips, it's not really a software that is for people, for users, but rather for producers. So we can't take that much when it comes to visualization, but the collation there is visualized quite nicely. For example, if you have a longer paragraph and it matches with a shorter paragraph in another version, they move variably to each other, which is quite a good solution to adopt. Okay, then generally the question whether it is smart to digitalize by simulating things. Like, we could always digitalize it like this. We could take historical critical editions, start with the first stage that was written or that is included, and then simulate step by step by step. And I think it is probably not the most efficient way of digitalizing things, but it was quite experimental, and I think what we can learn from it is that we could automate quite a lot of things. Like when I'm changing the user, for example, I only have to log out and log in again, and I could set up in a specialized environment to simulate something like that. I could set up the users that are actually working on the text and just click on the user, and all the changes I'm doing are then stored for this user. It's of course not working like that in MediaWiki, because MediaWiki was not planned to do something like that. But it would be potentially quite gewinnbringend. Yeah. Anyway, and I think that's basically all I wanted to say. And sorry that I was speaking that fast, but I just wanted to get through because we already spent so much time.
Thank you very much. First, my question, you really found, and this you also realize, that the more and more information annotation you put into the XML file, the more and more it gets inflexible. And I think this will be, for the next hours, could be a point of discussion. Where are the limits of annotation with XML? Is it possible, is it necessary to have new technology? You showed some technology with external databases.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. I think markup is quite important, that's no question, but the question is where's the extra meaning or the extra outcome of a thicker description in TEI? If we then always use XSLT to transform it into HTML, which is not as descriptive, and then kind of try to find other solutions using CSS to represent the information we just cut out. And that's what we're of course asking us when we're digitalizing things like the Virginia Woolf information here.
Some more questions?
It's not really a question, but I agree very much with this point that XML, and it would be a longer discussion, not now, has some limits, and it has to do with the history of XML. XML had a very narrower task in the past, and now there are many, many tasks put on XML and annotation. And I say only one word, standoff markup may be a step in the future. And standoff markup may also be put into databases in classical lit.
I mean, a clear example of such standoff markup, and that brings me back to Hans Walter's comment, is when we now want to give, to add information about the contents of the Wittgenstein texts. We have in principle two ways. We can do that in the XML transcription, say this is about freedom of will or whatever, or we can do this standoff involving the user community. Then of course the better way is the second one, because there will be debates about what is the remark really about. And as long as the user annotations are all linked to the same SIGLO, right, then we can always, you know, afterwards, if anyone should want to import it into the XML. But there's no need for that. That would be a typical case of where one does definitely do it outside XML, or does it through standoff. Yeah. We do not want everything to be in the XML. That also makes it so, I mean, it's a huge problem then of coordinating all the different inputs. I mean, even our text genetic tables of this remark is a version of that remark over there. That's also outside the XML. Because there's one person can work on those tables, and in the meantime, another person can continue to correct the transcription.
This notion about the signal, which then acts as a URL,
yeah,
and a stable reference point. It's something that Hypermeetia and Wittgenstein sort of agreed on at an early stage.
Yeah.
And I think it's an absolutely critically important point. Now, as for the markup, of course, you're quite right about the XML being invented for something that one is trying to exceed in every direction nowadays. It is surface structure of a text, of a final text, printed text if possible. And all this kind of variation does not fall within it, really. Now, not concentrating so much on XML, but thinking of the markup, whether one puts it all in one file or whether one puts a standoff, it's also used, you were talking about, for so many purposes. You were talking about semantics, for example. Semantics is at a point of granularity, and it's also an interpretive thing in a sense, which goes beyond what, if one wants to establish the basis from documents, a simulation of the material basis of one's transmission, then one is very close at the writing, and one needs, I think, to design the markup very carefully in view of the many purposes one wants to see. One might want to see a very close imitation of the textual development and a visualization of that. One might also wish to do the kind of thing that you do your ontologies. I was interested in transcribing this Virginia Woolf material from the beginning, also because I could see this is autobiographical material, it's not fictional, it's something that really has to do with Virginia Woolf and her memory of that young Virginia Woolf. It has to do with her changing memories or reflections on her father, her mother, etc. It has to do with family relationship, it has to do with social situations in late Victorian England, and I want to get at those various content aspects of it, and I want to have the markup in such a way that these things can be extracted either directly or indirectly. One of the problems, of course, that we do have is that visualizations are far less developed than one's ideas about what one should be able to put into markup. So our project, our Passau, Frankfurt, Austin, and Lincoln, Nebraska project, Wittgenstein is, not Wittgenstein, his name is Walt Whitman. It's close enough. They are in there, and one of the objectives of the project is also to have first building blocks for visualization, so to do something with the markup that we're trying to design.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, 2 minutes break, and then we start with the finale, grande finale. 2 minutes break.